futuro.
And they're trying so hard to be able to help put food on the table, to be able to make ends meet. And that's the great irony, is that they're struggling to eat, those people that feed us.
Uno, dos, tres.
Hey, family, welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Norma Flores Lopez. She's Chief Programs Officer at Justice for Migrant Women. Hey, Norma, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great. And joining us from Woodburn, Oregon, is Reina Lopez, literally on the other side of the country. Reina is Executive Director of Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noreste, pues órale, or PICUN, which is Oregon's largest farm worker union. Hey, Reina, welcome to the show.
Gracias. Thanks for having me.
Love it.
And before we get to the conversation, just a reminder, we are still recording remotely. So if there's any strange noises, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
I'm really, really thrilled that the both of you are joining us. Such an important conversation that we're going to be having today about the nation's roughly 2.4 million farm workers. You know, there are posters and signs and flags and commercials that love the essential workers, right? The majority of these particular workers, the farm workers, are Latino and Latina immigrants. And, you know, everybody knows that we would not have had food on our tables had it not been for them.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that about a third of farm workers live below the poverty line, which makes no sense, right? Because they are feeding us.
Mm.
We do know, oh my God, the work conditions, we can talk about that. It's pretty extraordinary. Total physical, mental health challenges all the time, every day.
Yeah.
And as we know, the COVID-19 pandemic only intensified a lot of these inequities. So really, I love these communities. I love spending time in these communities. And I just want to say before anything, thank you for the work that you do on behalf of the people who do this work in the farms and delivering our food. So I just want to check in with you personally. Like, how are you doing? Because you are there working and advocating for the farm workers. ¿Cómo están? Like, what's your temperature check? Y Norma, let's start with you. ¿Cómo estás?
I'm doing well. A lot to be grateful for. I think that the pandemic really allowed folks to be able to reassess what's really important and what matters out here. And this work that I get to do, I feel very privileged to be able to do it. I had my opportunity of growing up and working in the fields, and I know what hard work it is. And I know how blessed I am to be able to now, you know, work from home. It's something that wouldn't have been possible before when I was working out in the fields.
Right.
To be able to be in air conditioning, to have a clean glass of water. Those are all things that I'm very grateful for. But, you know, with this pandemic, we knew what it also meant for our communities and why we needed to mobilize. And so we've been working around the clock. And so I'm tired, but a good kind of tired. I'd rather be this kind of tired than the sore muscles and the cuts that I used to have from working in the fields.
Right.
But extremely grateful and just really focused on making sure that as we rebuild, it's going to be a different kind of future for those farm workers out in the fields that we're so grateful for.
Thank you, Norma, especially for bringing gratitude into the conversation. I think many of the farm workers who I've spoken with, this is part of their lives, right? Grateful for the land that gives us this bounty. Reina, ¿y tú cómo estás?
I think that for me, I'm full of esperanza. I'm full of hope. And every single day when I'm talking to my organizers, our members, I'm just feeling like we need to hold the vision, eyes on the prize, and really trying to just stay focused, honestly, because there is a lot going on in the world that can make us feel down about where we're at, but we're ready to just keep moving forward. La lucha sigue, as we say in the movement.
Hell yes.
Yeah. Hell yes, says Maria Hinojosa. But speaking of what we've been going through, and thank you both for sharing sort of that temperature check, because it's really important to sort of frame where we want to go with this conversation, because this summer, the United States has already experienced record-shattering heat, right? And unprecedented wildfires. Farm workers are 20 times more at risk from heat stroke than other workers. And that's according to the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC. And because of climate change, the average number of days that farm workers need to work in unsafe temperatures every year will only continue to increase. So on June 26th, a 38-year-old migrant farm worker named Sebastian Francisco Perez died after working for hours at a farm in Oregon in temperatures that reached over 100 degrees. 2 weeks later, Oregon Governor Kate Brown implemented emergency heat standards to better protect workers in the state. However, there are still no federal protections from heat exposure in the workplace.
I mean, what the hell? What the hell?
I know. And advocates are calling on OSHA, which is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the federal agency, to establish federal heat standards. Reyna, you have been on the ground in Oregon. I would love for you to share sort of what happened during that time, and you can talk about the impact of the climate crisis on farm workers right now. What can you tell us?
Well, first, let me tell you just a little bit about Sebastian Francisco Perez. He was 38 years old. He was working at a tree farm in St. Paul, Oregon, in Marion County, one of the top agricultural districts in our state. And he came here from Guatemala. He literally got here on Cinco de Mayo. And when I was talking to his primo, he was telling me that Sebastian Francisco had so many dreams. He was a very serious person. Whenever he talked about his family back at home, he'd talk about how him and his wife wanted to have a baby and that she was having a lot of trouble getting pregnant. And he was planning on saving up money to help them start a family. And unfortunately, that dream never came true. And we've been trying to really not only humanize the story, but say, hey, we needed these heat rules yesterday. Right now, I mean, we have little faith that the federal government can actually pull a lot of things off, but we really need to hold their feet to the fire in every way, shape, and form. And we need to be really clear that heat standards need to happen. We need smoke standards as well, because frankly, here on the West Coast, what we're seeing too is wildfires as well. We have the biggest wildfires in Southern Oregon right now. And last year, we had whole communities, farm worker communities, that were completely destroyed. And we need to demand that our lawmakers pass policy that actually works for our communities and that addresses the long-term effects of global warming. Because we're kidding ourselves if anyone believes that we should just be pretending that nothing's happening and that we should just live with it. Doing that means that millions of people will die, right?
Wow.
And now, you know, in Oregon, we really joined the struggle with our family down in California and Washington for months. We've been demanding that, specifically on the local level through Oregon OSHA, that they implement emergency rules around fire and smoke. And we were met with a ton of resistance until this tragedy happened, the preventable and tragic death that happened.
Right.
And what we know right now is that on the national level, they were paying attention. We did get some calls from our congressional delegates and our senators as well. And we are in huge support of the Asunción Valdiva Heat Illness and Fatality Prevention Act, named in the honor of another farm worker that died in 2004 after picking grapes for a 10-hour straight day, 105-degree temperature. And that would require OSHA on the national level to establish an enforceable standard to protect workers in high heat environments with measures like basic things that we want, right? Very basic things. We're not actually asking for luxuries. We're asking for basic things like paid breaks and cool spaces, access to cool and clean water. We want to be limited to the time exposed in the heat. We want to have a plan when workers are being exposed to high heat, extreme weather conditions. We want plans for heat-related illness, and we want people to be trained on the job so that we know what to do when these problems come and arise.
And by the way, Reyna, I just want to say thank you for humanizing Sebastian in that way.
Yeah.
That's what we need to realize, is that every single farm worker who is feeding us has hopes, dreams, want to have a baby, a house, whatever. So thank you so much for bringing Sebastian from Guatemala very much alive for us.
Right.
It feels like you want the federal government to recognize these workers as human beings. My goodness, water. Okay, just clean water.
Right. And the thing is, Karina just said 2004.
My God.
That's 17 years ago.
This country, yo, this country.
So, Norma, I mean, hearing what Karina said, what would you like to see done to ensure the well-being of farm workers in light of this climate crisis?
Well, as you mentioned, it's incredibly frustrating because we have been in this fight and we have been doing this work, you know, for decades.
Right.
And for us, we're asking for some of the most basic common sense. We know the science already behind it. We know what it takes to be able to keep people protected. And it's infuriating because when you hear the other side about why it is that these things don't go through, there's not any real logical science-based reason other than they don't want any additional regulations or protections out there. And it goes back to, as Reina mentioned, the need to be able to humanize and to show people you wouldn't want to work in these conditions. You wouldn't want your loved ones to be out there. Mm-hmm. So why are we okay with the food that all of us eat every single day, how they get to our plates? How are we okay with the fact that they're not given some of these basic rights? Because this is just scratching the surface about what are some of those basic rights that farm workers continue to be denied. And it's not even documented, undocumented sort of thing. All farm workers are exploited. All farm workers are treated unequally under the laws.
Right.
And going back to the heat issue, I mean, we know how to be able to prevent some of these deaths. Basic common sense, hydration, shade, rest breaks.
Right, right.
Those basic things is what we're asking the government to be able to provide us. You know, make sure that the farm workers that are out there have those basic protections that every other American, every other worker in this country is able to have. The fact that we are still fighting 17 years later for this bill and for many of these other basic protections that we've been asking for decades later.
Yep.
I mean, it highlights some of the fundamental problems in this country.
So we do know that the history of farming in this country has deep-rooted ties, yes, to slavery and institutional racism.
Of course.
You know, the things that this country, sadly, were built on.
Right.
So in 1938, the Fair Labor Standards Act in the United States purposely excluded farm workers from basic labor protections. I remember when I learned about this and you're just like, wait a second. You have
right.
Fair Labor Standards in 1938. And then other people are like, yeah, but you don't get them.
But not for the Mexicans. Not for the Mexicans.
Right. Not for the farm workers. Not for the Mexican farm workers and the Filipino farm workers.
Exactly.
And the Black farm workers and Indigenous and Asian farm workers.
Exactly.
So they don't get access to minimum wage or capping the work week at 40 hours
right.
or a ban on child labor. No,
right.
That doesn't happen. Some of those exclusions continue to this day.
Crazy.
Almost 100 years later, farm workers still don't receive overtime pay in a majority of states. In nearly all states, children as young as 12 years old can legally work an unlimited number of hours on any farm, as over 500,000 children do every year. Last month, the Supreme Court struck down a California law allowing farm worker unions access to the work site,
yeah,
making it more difficult to organize farm workers. Okay, so what's up with that? Camila Chavez is executive director of the Dolores Huerta Foundation, and she spoke about the Supreme Court decision on Democracy Now in late June. So let's take a listen.
This ruling is a setback for unions, for workers' rights. The idea that organizers who are on property after giving notice or taking property is ridiculous and clearly a union vesting position. A farm company said that union access allowed, quote, physical invasion of land without compensation. So we know that when it comes to workers that live in the labor camps, they are living on private property. They're then shuttled to work in company vehicles. Union organizers would have no access to these workers in this case.
So, Norma, you actually worked in the fields as a child. And some of my students, same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That I would hear stories of waking up at 2, 3 in the morning.
Right.
Car lights, headlights on so that they could pick asparagus for 3 to 4 hours before they went to school.
Wow.
And did this as a family.
Wow.
But
yeah, yeah.
We all need to be seeing more protection for farm workers. I mean, should there even be child farm workers?
Right.
So what do you think, Norma, from your kind of professional and personal experience on this?
As you mentioned, I grew up as a migrant farm worker. My family and I would pack up our belongings at the beginning of every summer from South Texas and would make the drive up north to the states like, you know, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, Colorado to go work and harvest and all kinds of fruits and vegetables.
Wow.
So much so that I had a strong dislike for certain vegetables that I had to pick out there, like asparagus. I couldn't see it for years. I was just not a fan.
Damn.
Because of just having to do that backbreaking work as a young child.
Yeah.
Like many farm workers, I started around the age of 9, I started like with play, you know, having to be out there with my parents who didn't have anybody to watch me.
Yeah.
And making sure that they could keep an eye on me while I picked some of the low-hanging fruit or some of the fruit that fell on the ground.
Wow.
And it was more like a game at that point. And then I started working legally at the age of 12, which is when it's the federal law allows for me to be able to sign up and work a full-time job during the summer. And this isn't a 9-to-5, you know, 5 days a week,
right.
you know, fun summer job. It was backbreaking work of 10 to 12 hour days of doing intense labor and intense weather conditions, like the ones you were describing, of over 100 degrees outside. Damn. And having to detassel corn or having to be able to, you know, harvest onions. And so that was what I did alongside my parents out of necessity, not because it was any vocational training, not because I had a future in farming. And there were times where I had to work alongside some of the local kids that grew up in those agricultural communities, those kids that were white. And the treatment that I would see between those kids and myself as a child was night and day.
Right.
I would get yelled at, insulted, called all kinds of names while I was working out there in the fields, demanded to go faster and harder.
Wow.
And while the other kids were literally having a very different summer experience, it's hard to yell at them and to insult them when you're going to go to church on Sunday with their parents.
Whoa. Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Norma, can you tell me what would they say? Because I'm still kind of stuck with, like, so Norma is 12 years old and now she is being talked to by a boss.
Wow.
She has a boss at 12 years old and she's being yelled at by that boss.
Yeah.
So what were you hearing as a little kid working? What were the things that they were saying to you and not to the white kids?
What they would tell me would be, what the fuck are you doing? Why are you wasting time?
Wow.
We need to go faster. Quit talking.
Wow.
You can't even do this. What good are you? What are you going to even be in the future if you can't even fucking manage to do this sort of work?
Whoa.
You're worthless. I mean, those were literally words that would tear at me. And my mother, who spoke no English, would be standing there staring at me and be like, what's happening, Norma? ¿Qué está pasando? ¿Qué te dice? And I would be like,
ay, Dios.
Nothing, Mom. I missed a thing. He's just telling me it's fine. I would absorb so much of it. Even at that age, I knew what was happening to me was wrong, but I also knew how much my parents depended on those wages.
Mm.
And so I would just sit there and take it and tell my mom, it's fine, Mom. He's not saying anything to me, because I also knew that that farm was paying my parents better, that that farm was not stealing their wages like the ones that we had been at before.
Damn.
And so I would just take it. And it was a full summer of just that sort of mistreatment and abuse. And in my head, I would think, like, this isn't who I am. I'm actually a very smart student. I'm actually not dumb. I get the highest grades in classroom. But to them, out in those fields, I was seen as nothing, as a worthless employee that was brown, that was going to be a nothing to them. And it was a lot to absorb at 12.
Seriously.
Damn. Oh, my God. Norma, you know what? Thank you so much for painting that picture for us, because that picture, as you know, is happening right this very moment.
All the time.
As we speak, recording this, we know that that is being repeated everywhere across our country, right?
Absolutely.
So thank you for allowing us to understand. And sabes que eres una mera, mera chingona. Nomás quiero decir.
Thank you.
Norma, eres una chingona sobreviviente y órale.
Así es. Así es.
I will take that. I will take all of that and absorb all that energy. But there's so many kids that are out there that don't have cheerleaders to remind them of that they can do well. And so what you end up seeing is kids that are working in the fields that drop out at four times the national average,
right,
and don't finish their school and are trapped in this generational cycle of poverty, of having to go work in those fields and doing their best. I mean, every child that's out there is because their parents need that money and they know that, and they're trying so hard to be able to help put food on the table, to be able to make ends meet. And that's the great irony, is that they're struggling to eat those people that feed us. And so what we're trying to be able to do is to say, equalize the child labor laws. The same way that we protect every other child working in every other industry, making sure that they're doing safe jobs that aren't going to cost them their lives, because agriculture is one of the deadliest. It is the deadliest industry for children to be working in. We are trying to be able to keep these kids from having to choose their education or feeding their families at such young ages. We want them to complete school. So what we're asking is equality in the child labor laws. Don't allow for these kids to be so young doing such dangerous work, that we have the science that shows how dangerous it is, the data that proves that, and to be able to make sure we're protecting those kids.
Yeah, this one piece of data, every day, approximately 38 farm worker children are injured in the U.S., and that's from Children in the Fields on Twitter, CIF campaign.
Yeah.
So, Reina, you're in Oregon. I mean, what do you want to see in terms of better protection for farm workers and their families and this conversation of child labor.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with Norma, and I agree also that you're a chingona badass.
Yes. Thank you, Rima.
And all of the things. And I really want to also point out how systems of oppression and racialized caste systems really are at play here. And this is also why I think that Black and Brown unity in this conversation, in this time, is so crucial, because we have a common thread here. And the reason why we see these kinds of statistics, the reason why we know that the average life expectancy of a migrant farm worker is 49 years of age, why we see so many miscarriages in our communities, why we see all of these quality of life standards just being at the bottom of the barrel, is because we're living in a system that has really taken on into the legacy of what slavery did. Yeah. And a lot of these New Deal era reforms that were supposed to be monumental labor standards for the United States, the legacy of Jim Crow laws and slavery was institutionalized in the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Yeah.
And in the National Labor Relations Act, too, which excluded farm workers and domestic workers from collective bargaining and unionizing rights. And we know, too, that labor union power at that time was growing, and it was also viewed as a way to mobilize racial integration and racial right. power. And many of the exclusions that happened at that time really were created to stop that and completely slow it down. In Oregon, we've been trying to do a lot of these piecemeal efforts, right, to make some of these things right. Even just this past year, we tried to pass House Bill 2358, which would have ended the farm worker exclusion from overtime pay for both hourly and piece rate workers. And that would have ended nearly a century old discrimination and boosted pay for farm workers. But we also saw legislators in a progressive blue state
yeah.
say that we're not going to prioritize this, even though six other states already had it. And Washington just passed theirs.
So around half of farm workers in the United States are undocumented, right? Which can put workers at even greater risk of exploitation. That's a fact. So now there's an act in yeah. D.C. It's called the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, which is trying to change that. And that proposal would offer an estimated 1 million undocumented farm workers a pathway to citizenship.
Yeah.
Senate Republicans have pushed back against the bill, which passed the House in March. But there's actually been some disagreement on the bill between farm worker advocates, because the bill contains lengthy work requirements and because it could freeze the minimum wage for temporary agricultural workers for a year. So Trini, who is a farm worker with La Unión del Pueblo Entero in the Rio Grande Valley, the RGV, spoke at a rally where she called for a pathway to citizenship for herself and other workers. Let's take a listen to what she says in Spanish.
Yo como trabajadora en el campo he andado desde las 4 de la mañana hasta que se mete el sol. Y aquí está la prueba, en mis manos todas cicatrizadas, cortando cebollas, cortándome las manos para tener un hogar para mis hijas. Tengo 3 hijos y yo no quiero criar delincuentes a este país. Yo vengo a darle a este país, pero también quiero que el país me responda, que no nos saquen de esto que está pasando ahorita, que nos dejan fuera. Dicen que esenciales, entre comillas, pero ¿dónde estamos los trabajadores esenciales?
Yeah, I love that. Dicen que.
I know. So just a quick sort of summary before I ask our fabulous guest some questions. First of all, I'm really glad that we ran that in Spanish, because it's just very hard to translate that beauty of that voice. But basically what Trini is saying, that she's working long days to provide for her children, her daughters. This is the part that hit me, Maria.
Mm.
The proof is in the scar in my hands.
Scars, multiple scars. Yeah.
Multiple scars. You want proof? Here's the proof. She's worked so hard for her country. She's just asking for her country to give it back. She also mentions, like, you know, I'm not raising delinquent kids, and everyone's talking about essential workers in quotes, entre comillas. Well, show up for us. Like, show up for us.
Yeah.
Wow. Powerful words. So, Reina, talk to us about the need for a pathway to citizenship for farm workers. And how do you feel about the current bill, the Farm Workforce Modernization Act? How do you feel about it?
Well, first I'll say, lo que dijo Trini sí pegó duro, right?
Yes.
Sí, no, pegó durísimo. Yeah.
Right. Duele.
Duele, it hurts. It definitely does.
Yeah.
And I think that workers like Trini deserve everything and more, right? And right now with HR 1603, I'll tell you right now, it's a compromise bill. But despite the fact that it's compromised, Pecun is supporting it. Really what it does, it creates an earned path to legalization and citizenship. And basically, if there's a worker that's been working 180 days in the agricultural industry within 2 years prior to the passage of the bill, they qualify for this status called certified agricultural worker status. Mm-hmm. Some of us call it the blue card for short, like la tarjeta azul is what a lot of our members call it. And with that basically protects you from deportation, and it actually allows people to have ability to travel back and forth to see family in other countries.
Yeah.
And basically, it does come with a couple of things, though. You have to pay a fine. It makes you go through a background check. But with the CAW, you can basically renew it every 5.5 years. Or if you've been working in agriculture for 10 years and you commit to working another 4 years in agriculture, you can qualify for legal permanent residency status. But if you've been working less than 10 years, you have to work with it for another 8 years to qualify for LPR status. And basically, once you have LPR status for a minimum of 5 years, you can actually apply for citizenship.
Yeah.
That we're like, yeah, there's a path, but it's a compromise path. The parts that were major compromises that were really tough to swallow, but we're like, we got to keep moving forward, were what you mentioned, the 1 year wage freeze.
Yeah.
Another part that was really hard to swallow on the bill, frankly, was the compromise around E-Verify.
Right. And E-Verify, what it does, it's a database that searches government records to verify someone's identity. And basically, the system has actually been used to continue raids and detentions of undocumented immigrants, because once you're in the system,
yeah,
people can find you.
You know, one thing I will say is that there's some support. There's some folks that are not supporting it. And the reason why we did support it was it kind of rang a little bit similar to what we felt in 1986 when the immigration reforms happened back then.
Under Ronald Reagan and the Democratic House.
Republican Ronald Reagan and Democratic House, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. There was division, too, amongst advocates at that time as well. But 1986 is the reason why I'm here today. I mean, I think that that was also a transformational policy that
absolutely
didn't have all the support of all the advocates. And,
right.
You know, I truly believe I would not be here today if it wasn't for my family being able to access a lot of that. I mean, the bottom line is that we do not have the votes, even with this compromise bill. And we know that roughly 1.2 million undocumented farm workers could be able to benefit from this program. And our members, you know, even though they were like, yeah, this is very compromised, but we got to keep moving and we got to support it in order to make something happen.
Yeah.
And this is one of the very few policies that we've seen that has bipartisan support.
Yeah.
It's definitely something that we're going to have to take some heat around with our own community, but I think that we know that this is going to have to be just one step in the bigger picture that we're trying to move forward.
I don't know, Julio, the whole thing where it's just like, yeah, well,
yeah,
you're a farm worker, back-breaking work, but
yeah,
you only did it for, oh, only 10? Yeah, you got to do more. And it's just like, how much more do you have to prove? Which
kind of
makes me think about that message being given to our farm workers, which is that they are not worthy.
Yeah.
Which is untrue.
I know. And Norma, what are your thoughts about the bill or about the pathway to citizenship for farm workers? What can you share?
A pathway to citizenship is absolutely necessary. It is a game changer. It is a difference for these farm workers and their ability to be able to access aid. I mean, even throughout the COVID pandemic, farm workers were among those that are undocumented that were excluded from some of these relief packages that were being passed.
Yeah.
These folks that were out there feeding us, working throughout the pandemic, risking their health and that of their family, were being denied the aid that they so desperately needed. And so for us, we understand that it's not perfect, but we know what a difference it'll make in the lives of these farm workers. As we would hear stories of them leaving bags packed and notes posted and neighbors informed of like, if I get picked up by a raid, can you take care of my kids? Can you pick them up from school? Having to have these contingency plans because they were afraid that they wouldn't be able to see their children again and wanted to make sure that their children were okay, sending them to school with food in their backpacks. I mean, this is a huge difference to them to be able to access that. And as mentioned, you know, from the 2.5 to 3 million farm workers in this country, approximately half are undocumented. So this is such a huge game changer for the community to access that sort of help.
Yeah.
And these folks have experienced decades of traumatizing work conditions, economic insecurity, violence, sexual assault, the threats of deportation, and so much vulnerability. And all of this was just exacerbated over this last year because of COVID-19.
Right.
And this is part of a bigger issue that we're seeing. It's not just farm workers, but farm workers are part of essential workers. And that's why with Justice for Migrant Women, we're one of the founding organizations for the Always Essential campaign, which is a national campaign focused on transforming what is possible for essential workers. And so farm workers, as we've mentioned, were deemed essential workers by the government throughout the pandemic, but they haven't been treated as such. And this is a $1.1 trillion sector in America.
Right.
And so for us, we're also supportive of the bills that are out there too, to be able to provide a pathway to citizenship to essential workers, because that's the struggle that we're seeing across. I mean, there's 5 million undocumented immigrants that made those sacrifices, that were part of frontline jobs, that were essential industries, healthcare, home care, transportation, food production, construction, and farm workers that were in the agricultural industry. And so for us, we see it as the least we can do for these communities that right. are part of our society, a part of our country, that we saw how much they contributed and sacrificed and how important they were to keep us running. And so absolutely, we know that all of these bills may not be perfect, don't include everything, but it does what we need, which is provide them with the relief that they need,
yeah.
with the access to be able to come out of the shadows and be able to access the help that they need and be able to be confident when they go out and raise their hand for some of these abuses that they're seeing, because that's how they keep them under their thumb. I mean, the big thing about agricultural work that people are not naming, that it's all about control.
Absolutely.
They want to control these workers.
Exacto.
All right, let's move on to our final segment, which we call COVID coping.
So we want to end by recognizing the long history of organizing, resistance, and mutual care that exists in the farm worker movement. I think for me, I mean, Cesar Chavez, like, for serious, like, I didn't eat grapes for so many years as a Mexican kid growing up in Chicago. And that's what it looks like across the country, people seeing and identifying
right.
with the farm workers and the movement, right? So the COVID-19 pandemic has been really hard. More than 600,000 farm workers were infected with the virus, according to researchers at Purdue University. Still, farm workers and advocates step in where the government has fallen short in terms of protecting farm workers and their physical and mental health. So in a year that has really taken such a toll, I just wanted to end now. In La Última, can you talk about how you're coping and how you're also at the same time supporting workers?
Yes.
And yeah, we like to talk about joy and hope.
Yes.
And particularly, you know, farm worker joy
yeah.
as a form of resistance. So your thoughts, and we'll start with you, Norma.
Thank you. It's so incredibly important to be able to find ways to cope. As I mentioned, farm workers have been some of the hardest hit, have been dealing with decades of trauma, centuries of trauma. The indigenous communities, whether it was the Black slaves and then on to indentured farm workers, right down to now the Latinx farm workers that are out there in the fields, and all those other communities too. We have Haitian, Thai folks that are out there harvesting their fruits and vegetables. And all of these folks have had to endure so much out there. We started a Healing Voices project, which we came together with National Migrant Seasonal Head Start Association, Latinx Therapy, and the Eva Longoria Foundation to create a virtual therapy program for farm workers, where we're able to provide them with that mental health support, with being able to teach them with skills on how to be able to, because we just kind of just buckled down, right?
Right.
We didn't have time to feel sad. Those feelings were real and they felt, but we just couldn't have the resources. We didn't have the language. We didn't have the ability to be able to face and deal with some of these things. And unfortunately, these traumas got passed down and passed down. And before you know it, I'm a 12-year-old getting yelled at by this white farmer,
right.
creating more trauma of my own. But we're trying to be able to give farm workers a way to be able to cope with some of these issues of treating their mental health just as important as we're treating the physical health. The same way we're pushing for those
right.
health standards to make sure that farm workers are safe in their physical body, we want to make sure that we also have an OSHA mental health standard developed as well for all workers, those folks that have been in the front line, because as you mentioned, we just went through a pandemic. It's huge. And it was traumatic for all of us as a planet. It wasn't even just here in our country. We're providing these sort of resources here at home I remind myself of where I came from and those roots and the work that needs to get done there. But I also am so happy that I get to be able to hold my little girl close and give her lots of hugs and kisses and know that she won't have to go out there in the fields the way I did and not have to work the way that I had to work to be able to make ends meet. And the fact that I, thanks to this vaccination, got to go hold my parents after being apart from them for, you know, a year and a half recently. And so that's been beautiful. My way of being able to cope with all of this is making sure that I'm taking care of myself.
Oh, we love that. Thank you, Norma. Reina, your thoughts?
For me, it's been just going back to my roots, especially around healing practices of Purépecha, Tarasco people, which is where my people come from in Michoacán.
Represent Michoacán.
And I think a lot of that, too, is just the integration of arte, movimiento, movement. One of the programs that we have going on at Becún, based out of the network of our sister organizations, is the Anahuac program, where it's really been based around indigenous healing practices, focusing on an ancestral wisdom of how we did our planting back in the Madre Patria, back in the motherland, and putting in different practices of how we utilize medicinal herbs and really the practices and rituals that we would do when we started harvest. And on the personal note too, lots of river time, lots of time in nature, lots of dancing, música. I think that that's really the thing that brings me a lot of joy. And, you know, one of my happy places is the river. The river has been just one of the most healing places for me and my family. And I'm really lucky that I get to live in a place right now, especially where wildfire season hasn't hit Multnomah County, Marion County, like it did last year. And just being able to do that on my time that I get to be, you know, with my family.
I'm just saying, Julio, nature heals. You have heard it from Reina Lopez.
I just want to put it on record. I'm down with rivers. I don't know if I can birdwatch, but I can do rivers and whitewater rafting and kayaking and all that. So I'm down with that.
Okay. Reina Lopez, Executive Director of Picún, and Norma Flores Lopez, Chief Programs Officer at Justice for Migrant Women. Thank you so much for bringing it real right here on In the Thick and joining Julio and me on this episode. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Uno, dos, tres.
And this episode was produced by our summer intern, Sarah Hershander. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Wow.
Great, great work. And remember, dear listener, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us. Thumbs up to Sarah, the intern, for producing this episode.
5 stars.
You can say that, yes. It really helps other people to find us. Also, you can remember now to listen to In the Thick wherever you decide to get your podcast on, Pandora, Spotify, you know. Check us out also on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell everyone you know to listen. In the Thick is produced by Noor Saadi, Harsha Nahata, and our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow, Lisa Salinas, along with our intern, Sarah Hershander, with editorial support from Charlotte Mangin and Nicole Rothwell. Our audio engineering team is Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, Leah Shaw Dameron, and Gabriela Baez. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional, Kept, and ZZ Key Records. And Raul Perez has a day off.
He didn't help you with the recording.
Not helping me. Nope, it's Harsha. It's all Harsha in the studio. Yeah. Thank you so much for listening, dear listener. Bye.
See ya.
I'm just like, I want to get the fuck out of this country. I mean, after watching Judas and the Black Messiah last night and then hearing about how they can't even fucking give them cold fucking water.
Okay, she thinks everyone's like tracking her now.
I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? I hate this country. And then I'm like, where am I going?
Okay.
There's no place to go.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.